Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC, New York Public Radio, this is the podcast of Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. This is just one segment of today's show. You can hear all of our conversations about New York's vibrant cultural scene on demand at WNYC.org. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC podcasts are supported by Holy Name Hospital in Teaneck, New Jersey, providing comprehensive centers in cardiovascular services, interventional radiology, and cancer care. More information at www.holyname.org.
Well, 5 minutes ago, the bells started ringing around the city of Salzburg in Austria. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. The bells began ringing a few minutes ago in churches around the city to celebrate what is, according to legend, the very moment that Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart was born 250 years ago today. And those bells may still be ringing. We'll find out now because joining us live in Salzburg is Fred Plotkin, a regular contributor to Soundcheck, author of books like Opera 101 and Classical Music 101. Fred, welcome back.
Thank you. Greetings to all of you.
So what's the situation there in Salzburg?
The bells have just stopped. I happen to be sitting in the Stiftskeller of St. Peter, which is a brewery which is run by the Benedictine monks of the Church of St. Peter, which is where the first bell rang about 20 feet from where I'm sitting. And this is happens to be a brewery where Mozart came to drink every night. So after we hang up, I'm going to go have a beer in his honor.
All right. A Mozart beer? I understand there's like Mozart yogurt and Mozart sausage and Mozart beer.
Well, there's
beer.
Mozart just about everything. ties and perfumes and Easter eggs and chocolates. I'm told that there's a Mozart brassiere. I've not found it.
How hard have you looked?
I've looked quite hard. I wanted to call it a duo in C major, but I have no idea where it is. No one seems to want to own up to where it is, but I'm told it's around.
So you are literally across the street from the St. Peter Church.
I'm literally across the street and around the corner from the dome, which is where he was baptized the day after he was born.
Mm-hmm.
And I went yesterday to visit the place where he was baptized, and I was reminded that on January 28th of 1756, he was doused in cold water. And the belief is that any baby who could survive the baptism would live to adulthood, because what I've learned among many things here is that most babies at that time did not survive.
Well, Mozart himself had six children, only two
survived. And a theme that keeps repeating when I travel around here and learn about Mozart's life is the degree to which death was omnipresent. And when I look now at his music and I hear some of the notes that he would strike on that issue, I better understand what he was about.
So there's been a whole week of celebrations there. It's been pretty cold there, hasn't it?
It has. Europe, as you know, has been freezing cold. Tonight is just a little bit warmer. And I came in about a half hour ago from the public square nearby, the Kapitelplatz, where they just served Mozart birthday cake to 1,000 people. And this being Austria, it was delicious cake. I don't know if you want the recipe.
Maybe not on the air, Fred.
Okay. But it was done for 1,000 people, and I must say it was very good.
All right. This idea of 8 p.m. Salzburg time, 2 p.m. our time, as the time of Mozart's birth, where did that legend come from? I mean, there's no notation on a birth certificate.
Actually, there is, because at that time, everything was run by the church, and this is a very small town even now. Salzburg, the metropolitan area, is 144,000 people, but then it was a little village. And I walked along the walls yesterday, and people were not allowed outside the walls. So as soon as the baby arrived, it was noted what time it arrived, and they baptized them quickly for the reason I described before, for fear that they would die before and therefore not find a place in heaven. So They were very precise about that, and we do know that it was 8 o'clock.
How about that? So one of the allegedly tall tales, not so tall after all.
But, no, I even saw the birth certificate.
Very good.
Yeah.
Fred Plotkin is with us in Salzburg, Austria, a few minutes ago with the window open, holding the phone out the window so we could record those bell sounds that sounded at 8 o'clock Salzburg time to celebrate the moment of the anniversary of Mozart's birth 250 years ago. So you've been to, have you been to the Mozart birth house?
I went to the birth house. You know, I want to underline something. I know a lot of people are saying how commercial it must be here. I've really not had that impression. They are very dedicated to the idea of Mozart, and he's not really being treated as a commercial entity. I frankly think that it's now time, 250 years later, that we stop treating him as a child prodigy and treat him as a sort of a full and complex human. And that's what I'm beginning to get here, so that the birth house and the Von House, which is where he lived, are exhibits about his life and times. And they opened another exhibit today called Viva Mozart that has a coffee shop that would have been what he knew. It has furniture that he knew. It has his books. It has the few original monographs that we have of his music, and they're making a real effort here, for the most part, to try to help people understand who he was beyond the charming boy genius, beyond the Amadeus. And my insight into that was the other night at 10:30 at night, Salzburg shuts down early, I went for a walk on the Getreidegasse, which is where he was born. I was the only person, and the sound of my footsteps, the dark lights, the chill in the air, I came to realize what he might have seen late at night in the winter, which is when he lived here.
So the whole idea of putting Mozart the man into the context of his time and his place seems to be very much at the fore of what's going on there.
And finally, frankly, because it's not that that always was the case here or elsewhere, he was, you know, a commercial commodity. The way Da Vinci now is with the Da Vinci Code, we no longer know who Da Vinci is, and it was getting that way with Mozart. And I'm very pleased to say that there seems, for the most part, to be a return to understanding the complexities of his life and to scrape away those silly myths about him. So either the charming ones about, you know, writing down things out of his head, mm-hmm. or the naughty ones. They're really talking about him as a religious person. I never knew that he loved to dance. And I saw the places where he would go dancing. There's a beer hall here where he danced, not the one I'm in. And he would learn steps, and those steps would then he would go home and write them down as music.
Hmm. He also loved billiards. Is there a pool hall there in Salzburg?
Well, I frankly thought it was billiards. There's a special kind of shooting that they would do here. They were sort of air darts. They had billiards, but they set up an air dart exhibit at the Viva Mozart exhibition that showed the kind of dart gun he used, and I got to shoot it. You can pay a euro and go shoot air darts at these silly little models of a man dropping his drawers and you aim for his backside, that kind of thing. So they were bawdy.
So
I don't want to give the wrong impression.
You're spending your time wisely then, Fred.
Exactly. It's in the pursuit of culture.
a final question. There's a big concert celebration this evening, and not without a touch of controversy.
Well, apparently Renee Fleming, according to the program that was written, was asked to withdraw. It seemed that the aria Chi io mi scordi di te, she did not want to sing, and, you know, singers have decisions about what's good for their voice and what's not in terms of repertory. The way the program was printed, it said for vocal reasons she would not sing. I found that rather poor taste. She was replaced by Cecilia Bartoli and another wonderful singer. I think they're both wonderful singers. But it was handled, I think, a bit tackily. They sort of asked her to withdraw.
Yeah.
It's not that Renee Fleming quit. She was asked to quit. But she did.
All right. Well, yeah. We actually will have a chance to check in with NPR's Fred Child at intermission of our live broadcast from Carnegie Hall of the Mozart 250 celebration tonight on WNYC. And that, Fred, will give us some more of the lowdown on the big concert celebration. But right now, Fred Plotkin is in Salzburg, Austria, where he has spent this week. And Fred, thanks so much for spending part of this birthday with us on Soundcheck.
Thank you, John.
This is Soundcheck. In a moment, the little-known story of how Mozart was appropriated by the Nazis. And then later, Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings turn up the funk in our performance studio. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer, and as we mark Mozart's 250th birthday today, Europe is a generally peaceful place. But in 1941, the 150th anniversary of Mozart's death was marked under much darker circumstances, namely World War II. And Mozart had become an unwitting icon for the Nazi propaganda machine. His works were used to promote Hitler's cause. Joining us to look at this seldom-told story is Eric Levy. He's a music journalist, broadcaster, and author of the book Music in the Third Reich. He joins us from London. He recently wrote about this topic for the BBC Music magazine. Eric Levy, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thank you.
It's pretty well known that Wagner seems to have been Hitler's composer of choice and that much of Wagner's music was appropriated by the Nazis. When and why did the campaign to appropriate Mozart get started?
Well, of course, it started pretty well in 1933 because, obviously, the Nazis coming to power in a democratic election wanted to appear to be seen as a respectable party to the middle classes, and in that way, they wanted to appear to be culture lovers, and they wanted to appropriate all the great music of the past. And they started, of course, in 1933. It was a rather fortuitous year because you mentioned Wagner, but it was also the centenary of Brahms' birth, and that was an opportunity for the Nazis to cash in on a particular musical event. And in 1935, of course, there were anniversaries of the births of Handel, Bach, and Heinrich Schütz, which the politicians got into. This idea of having festivals was a good one because it first of all gave musicians work because there was a lot of unemployment at the time, and it also kind of created a feeling of well-being amongst the German population.
Well, this is before the Anschluss, and Mozart.
Oh yes,
Mozart was of course Austrian, not German.
He was.
So were they already looking down that particular road, do you think?
Well, they were already thinking about the problem of performing Mozart because of his. There were two issues with Mozart that they needed to look at. One was the fact that Mozart was a Freemason and the Nazis were very opposed to Freemasonry. And, of course, Zauberflöte is a Masonic opera, and they were trying very hard to suppress any element of Masonic connection in that opera. And then, of course, the other problem was that Mozart's greatest librettist was Lorenzo da Ponte, and he was Jewish. And they wanted to, of course, in the Nuremberg laws, that there was actually, it was forbidden for an Aryan to work with a Jew. And so this meant there were sort of problems about performing Mozart's operas, particularly so in this case because the German translations in which they were most often performed were done by another Jew, Hermann Levy, who you may know in relation to Wagner. He conducted the first performance of Parsifal, but he also made these quite famous German translations, which were the standard way they were performed in German theatres.
So the Nazis really had a lot of twisting and turning to do to
absolutely, yeah.
To sort of repackage Mozart as a German symbol. So you mentioned Lorenzo da Ponte, a baptized Jew, but a Jew nonetheless. So that would seem to have ruled out Così fan tutte, Don Giovanni, and The Marriage of Figaro, the three great operas that the two of them collaborated on.
He would have, theoretically, but of course no opera house in Germany could not perform. I mean, you know, particularly Figaro and Don Giovanni were staple parts of the repertory, and the notion that they would be banned on such grounds would have caused kind of absurdity and perhaps a protest from the music fraternity. So obviously they couldn't go that far, but they tried as much as possible to take away the Jewish influence, and one way of doing that was to create new translations or to encourage writers to produce their own alternative translations to Lévy's and to suppress Da Ponte's name totally, so that Da Ponte was a non-person as far as they were concerned.
So not only did they need to suppress Da Ponte's original libretto, they also wanted to suppress the original German translation because it too had been done, as you say, by a Jew.
Well, the one that was favored at that time, there had been earlier translations, but the ones that were generally in use, had the widest currency, were by Hermann Lévy. You can still buy them in translation if you go to Germany and look at a piano score of a Mozart opera. Breitkopf and Hertel published those ones, so they're still in currency.
What about the new translations that the Nazis specifically commissioned for their own purposes? Are those still circulating?
Well, surprisingly enough, the one that was, well, it's quite a complicated story, and I'll try to sort of simplify it if I can. In the early 1930s, the translations that were most favored were done by a career opportunist who jumped on the bandwagon and saw that this would be a way of, you know, making money and assuming a kind of worthy alternative, in inverted commas, to Lévy. And then this guy, whose name was Siegfried Anheiser, his work was performed in certain theaters, but other theaters refused to go along with it, and there was a bit of a battle from the Nazi authorities to try and persuade various theaters to actually to learn these new translations, because of course a lot of opera singers had learnt their German versions of Figaro and Don Giovanni in the Lévy translations. They were rather reluctant to go along with new translations. But then, of course, you mentioned the Anschluss, that kind of changed things completely, because of course Austria now became Germany, and it was at that moment, just before the war, that the Nazis established a kind of organization for arranging music, and they then provided funds for an official translation, which was done with the blessing of the propaganda ministry. Mm-hmm. And a lot of money was put forward for that, and in fact, it was done under the sort of guise of scholarly activity, because they were Urtext editions. But if you look at the original scores, which they're actually housed in the British Library, they have the frontispiece. There's no mention of Da Ponte, and on the second page it says in big letters that this score has been commissioned by the Dr. Goebbels, and, you know, it's an official sort of translation. And in fact, the Nazis at that time produced a law which said that you couldn't perform Mozart except in this particular translation. And that translation is still current, actually. If you buy the Dover editions of the full score editions of the Mozart operas, which, of course, it's an American reprint, those are reprints of those 1940s editions. Amazing though it may seem.
That is amazing. Let me ask you, Eric, who were the Nazis aiming this? I mean, was this for the general public consumption? Was it a means, once things started going sour, to put on a happy face, as the song says?
I'm not quite sure what you mean by you mean in terms of the war, or
in terms of appropriating Mozart? Why bother? Who is this all for? Was it for?
Well, it was part of the ideology that they hammered home to everybody. You know, they couldn't have any kind of element of impurity in the great art. You know, it was a case. I mean, if you were thinking about performing, let's say, Schumann's Dichterliebe, which has poetry by Heinrich Heine, who's also Jewish, they had to sort of suppress the fact that Heine even existed. This was a way of making it palatable to the ideology of the time.
Okay, so it wasn't that it was meant to, I don't know, to sort of comfort the crowds, the general public, when, as I say, the war started to turn.
Ah, well, of course, then we're talking about a slightly different thing, that then to kind of make such a song and dance about Mozart became a kind of wartime propaganda thing, because Mozart's music was great, of course. It created a kind of balm in times of stress, but it was also used as a kind of nationalist symbol, because this was what the German artists were capable of, and the politicians used Mozart as a weapon in their fight against the Soviet Union, against their enemies. They used it as...
In fact, this recording that we're now hearing of Mozart's abduction from the Seraglio, this is a wartime recording made in September of 1944.
That's late.
By which time, yes, things had turned pretty sour indeed. But this is Elisabeth Schwarzkopf, great German singer, who seems to have been a fairly willing cooperator with the Nazis, although she downplayed it after the war. And this is an excerpt from Mozart's Abduction from the Seraglio. Well, in 1944, when the war had definitely turned against the Germans, I guess there was some comfort to be had in music like this from Mozart's Abduction from the Seraglio. Elisabeth Schwarzkopf with Rudolf Moralt conducting the Vienna Philharmonic in September of 1944. On Soundcheck, we are speaking with Eric Levy. He is author of the book Music in the Third Reich, and recently wrote about the attempted appropriation of Mozart's music by the Nazis in the BBC Music magazine. And, Eric, I suppose if I can go back to my very first question, we do know that that Wagner's music was appropriated with a great deal of success by the Nazis. Beethoven's music with far less success. And, you know, just from reading your article in the BBC Music magazine, it seems like the appropriation of Mozart was just a mess.
It was. They had to try and kind of cover up things, and they used subterfuge, really, and misleading information. I mean, Goebbels actually stood up at the 1941 festival in Vienna, marking Mozart's death, and said, you know, that of course the Masonic elements in Mozart's opera are not important. They have nothing to do with the opera itself. So he was deliberately misleading the public. And that's a very good example.
Yeah, it's just, and it seems like somehow Mozart's reputation was never really tainted with this whiff of not. It seems like the people in outside of Germany, at least after the war, you know, there was no problem playing Mozart's music in Israel, for example. You know, people, I think, just assumed that this was a crazy ploy on the Nazis' part.
It was. It was, indeed. But perhaps more interesting, of course, are some of the scholars who were working so hard to create this image of Mozart, of course, managed seamlessly to work on in post-war life as if nothing had happened. You mentioned the fact that Schwarzkopf downplayed her role in the Nazi era. I mean, these people simply kind of denied some of the articles, some of the statements that they'd made to support the regime.
Mm-hmm. Then there's the case of the great German conductor, Wilhelm Furtwängler, who actually refused to join the Nazi party, but, you know, was very much tainted by having stayed in Germany and you know, performed there during the Nazi regime. Do you know what his response to the various machinations of Mozart's music was?
Well, one interesting thing that I discovered when my research in Vienna was that in the 1940s, one of the most absurd things that the Nazis tried to impose on performers as far as Mozart was concerned was that they wanted or they tried to order people to perform Mozart's Requiem if they were going to perform a religious work with a revised text in which all elements of the Old Testament were removed. So words like Sabbath and Zion were simply suppressed, a new Latin translation was used. Now, I noticed that in this 1941 festival, which ended with the performance of the Requiem conducted by Furtwängler, I looked at the text and was quite pleased to note that the text was presented as Mozart had set it.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously there was some element of resistance to this kind of imposition, probably from Berlin. Because there was a famous recording, in fact, from 1941 in which this text is used without the Jewish words, or Old Testament words.
Right, but that was not a Furtwängler performance.
That was not a Furtwängler. It was his orchestra, the Berlin Philharmonic, but right. not him conducting. And it's interesting that when Furtwängler conducted the Requiem, he certainly didn't depress. Or he didn't bow to the pressure to perform it in this way. He probably would have thought it was absurd.
Well, let's actually hear a 1949, therefore post-war recording by Wilhelm Furtwängler here with the Vienna State Opera, and this is an excerpt from Act One of Mozart's The Magic Flute. An excerpt from Mozart's The Magic Flute, with Wilhelm Furtwängler leading the Vienna State Opera back in 1949. We're speaking with Eric Levy, who is author of the book Music in the Third Reich, and talking about the attempt by the Nazis to appropriate the music of Mozart. It's a seldom-told story, and Eric, I guess part of the reason is that it really was not a smashing success on the Nazis' part.
Yeah, it's interesting that after 1941, a lot of mention of Mozart seems to disappear. There were hundreds of books, literally hundreds of books, published in 1941 in celebration of Mozart, the Mozart anniversary. There were concerts, there were broadcasts, there was a special series of broadcasts which took place in all the occupied parts of Europe, because, of course, what they wanted to do was to trace Mozart's journey through his life and the various places that he visited. So, of course, they had a program from Paris, program from Milan. Of course, they were allies, and programs from the Czech Republic, where they, of course, the Germans occupied, and of course, Austria. The only place they couldn't get to, of course, was London. Mozart visited London when he was about six. I suppose had they been successful in the war, they would have, no doubt, broadcast a program from there as well.
I guess it is, finally, kind of proof of Mozart's resilience that he was difficult to appropriate, and that, as we say, whatever kind of stain of Nazism was on his music seemed to come right off once the war ended.
Absolutely, yes. I agree with that.
Music in the Third Reich is the name of the book by my guest Eric Levy. He's a journalist and broadcaster who has joined us today from London as we mark Mozart's 250th birthday today. Eric, it is a fascinating little footnote to the story of Mozart and his music, and I thank you for sharing it with us this afternoon.
Great pleasure.
You're listening to Soundcheck. In a moment on Soundcheck, things get a little funky. Actually, they get very funky as Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings pile into the studio and join us for a live performance. Stay with us. Thanks for listening to today's podcast of Soundcheck from WNYC, New York Public Radio. This was just one of the show's segments. You can hear everything we do on demand at WNYC.org. Check out our other podcasts at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.